Given the endless amount of advice floating around about setting and meeting goals, it's surprising how little we talk about the times they conflict. Say a goal of making sleep a priority every single night and a goal of being very responsive to overseas clients operating on a very different timetable. Our most wrenching struggles, of course, come when values seem to be mutually exclusive, like when you value deep loyalty and you value truth. If the person or group you're loyal to starts to say things that aren't true, how are you supposed to square that? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Valerie Tiberius is Paul W. Frenzel Chair in Liberal Arts and Professor of Philosophy at the University of Minnesota. She sees learning to manage conflicting goals and values as a critical life skill, because if we can't align these things, we will forever fall short of a good and happy life. She writes about this in a book called What Do You Want Out of Life? A Philosophical Guide to Figuring Out What Matters. Valerie, welcome to Think.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Most of us hear all throughout our lives about the importance of having values and setting goals, but there's not a lot of discussion around how to decide what those things should be, is there?
Well, there probably is in my little circle of philosophers, but I think you're right that in the general culture, there really isn't.
Before we get into talking about how to fulfill values and goals, I should ask, why are goals necessary for a good life?
That's a good question. In a way, I think the answer is really just that goals are inevitable. We are just by nature goal-seeking creatures. So there's no getting away from having goals. Whatever there's different people have many different kinds of goals, but you're always going to have something as a goal, even if your goal is to become less goal-centered, you know, to become less of a type A personality, you're going to have goals. So I think conflict between goals and being frustrated in your pursuit of goals is one of the main things that competes with being happy and with feeling fulfilled and living a good life. And that's why it's important to think about which are the most important goals and how to resolve those conflicts.
What is special about a goal that rises to the level of being a value?
Yeah, so the way, the word values these days gets used in so many different ways to mean many different things. You have corporate values and family values and all of that. Philosophers are really, we tend to try to give very precise definitions of things, and sometimes our definitions are a bit weird. But the way I define a value is that it's a special kind of goal that is pretty important to you, so it's not a trivial goal, and it's something that's ideally it's integrated in your personality, so it brings together your feelings and your desires and your thoughts about how to live your life. So values are those kind of very central psychologically fitting, you know, they fit you as a person. They're that kind of goal.
Do values tend to be more stable over time than goals might be?
Yeah, and I do think that's part of it. Part of what it is part of what defines these special kinds of goals is that they do tend to be more stable. Goals are, that is a huge category. I mean, you know, one of my goals is to have lunch after this meeting, after this interview, and that's not very stable. It'll be gone in 2 hours, right? But my values, things like doing interesting intellectual work and spending time with my family and showing them that I care about them, those things have been with me for decades and will likely be with me for more decades.
So it's one thing, I think many people have thought about, you know, whether we hold the right values. I don't know that we're often encouraged, as we are in this book, to specifically think about whether we have the right values for our own circumstances and temperament.
Yeah, It's funny too, because, you know, at least in North America, we have such an individualistic culture. So it's a bit surprising that I don't know, I find it a bit surprising that we don't think about values that way. But it's also, it's easy to kind of overstate that point about finding values that fit you, because I do think that at a very general level, most of us have more or less, not exactly the same, but most of us have quite similar values. If you ask people what their deepest values are, they tend to say things like, you know, satisfying work, family, security, health, friendship. So we have those at that very, very general level. We have that in common with most people. But then it's at the more specific level of like, what do those values really mean? How do those values get translated into what you actually spend your time doing? How are those values prioritized against each other? Like how, you know, which takes precedence when? Those are the places where I think it's important to think about individual fit with the, you know, fittingness with our individual personality.
So if I understand this correctly, and please correct me if I don't, classic existentialist philosophy tells us there's no such thing as absolute values, right? That things matter insofar as they matter to us as individuals. You sort of agree with that to a point, but you also note we don't exist in a vacuum, right? We all live out our values in the context of other people.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the existentialists are famous for thinking that there is no human essence. Choice comes before essence. So they think that, I mean, essentially you could choose to make your life about whatever you want. I'm a little bit more impressed with the kind of stickiness of human nature. I think there are a lot of features of us as products of human evolution and normal human development that are just, you know, not possible to change. We are profoundly social creatures who need other people in our lives to do all sorts of things. And I don't think that's something we could choose to reject. I mean, you know, there are people who go sit on the tops of mountains and don't communicate with other people for many years, but those people are quite unusual. Most of us, that social part of our nature really affects the things that it could ever make sense for us to value.
Of course, other people might want to influence our values and goals. How should we decide when to integrate that input and when we ought to ignore it?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's a really hard question because it's hard to say too much in general about that. So, you know, one of the things I talk about in the book is that when you're trying to figure out what your own values are, it can be helpful to learn from other people, like from your good friends or people who love you. The sort of facts about your emotional reactions to things or your patterns, you know, we don't always know those things perfectly about ourselves. Sometimes other people can help us see how we're responding to the things we're doing in life. But, you know, sometimes your other person who's giving you this input, they could have their own agenda. So, you know, I think one of the examples I use in the book is you can imagine a person who's working as a kind of assistant in a company who would like to do an MBA degree and get promoted. And that person might ask their boss, do you think this is a good idea for me? And the boss thinks, oh, I love my assistant where they are. I don't want to lose this person. So the boss says, you know, I don't think you would really like the MBA program. I don't think it would fit your personality. Well, that's a place where you should be, you know, there's an example where it would be good to be skeptical about this other person's input, because you know, they do have an agenda. So it's worth when you, like, if you think about, you know, when are other people trustworthy and when are they not trustworthy, there isn't any sort of, you know, five easy steps to recognizing untrustworthy people. But you can think about when is it like, when do other people have something invested in what you do? And when are they really looking out for your interests? So that's one thing you can think about.
I thought this was so interesting. How can boredom be useful as a tool to indicate that our goals or values might not be working for us?
Yeah, there's been some praise of boredom recently because, you know, people have said, well, we're addicted to our phones, and part of the reason we can't get off of our addiction, we can't quit our addiction, is that as soon as, you know, finally my phone and I don't have my Wordle and my bee puzzle or whatever things I do on my phone, I'm immediately bored. And that kind of boredom can be valuable, actually, in order to kind of get through it and help you overcome a kind of fixation on technology and always having that kind of stimulation from technology. But aside from that, boredom is intrinsically bad, I think. It feels bad. It decreases your energy. It doesn't make it easier for you to fulfill your goals. In fact, makes it more difficult. So if you find yourself doing something where you are sort of habitually bored by the activity, it's a sign that that activity, that thing, that goal is not very suited to your personality. It's not bringing you joy. It's not making you feel proud of yourself. It's not engaging your intellectual faculties. So that's the way I think we can learn from boredom. You know, I'm not saying boredom is to be avoided at all costs. There might be times where accepting a little boredom can get you through to some better place, but for its own sake, boredom is just bad and a sign that what you're doing doesn't fit you.
What do morally good values contribute to a life that feels good overall?
I think that because we are such, as we were talking about earlier, because we are such profoundly social creatures, doing things that benefit other people is a kind of a good bet for an activity that's gonna make you feel like you've done something meaningful, something that will make you feel good about yourself and good about the benefit that you've done. Doing good things for other people connects you to other people. It can strengthen your relationships in your community or with your friends and family. So if we think about moral values as, if we think about like generosity and altruism and giving, those kinds of values, they tend to fit people very well because of how social we are.
All right, just for purposes of the conversation, Valerie, we will skip ahead and assume we have figured out what we believe our values and goals ought to be. You know, our culture sometimes maybe assumes that because values and goals are both good, they will just work themselves out when the time comes. How often, though, is our experience of stress in daily life actually tied to some kind of conflict between goals and values?
Yeah, that's a really central question in the book. But before I talk about stress, can I just push back on your framing a little bit?
Yeah.
So just that the assumption that we've got it all sorted out, that's cool for the conversation. But I just want to say, I don't think we ever have it all figured out. I think it's a process. And this is the thing that you learn as you get old, is that you just never figure it all out there because things keep changing. Your circumstances change. You get, your body starts to fall apart. Your parents become, you know, start to need your help, and your children grow up. And so the changes mean that it's not quite a like linear process where you figure it out and then you deal with conflicts. But that said, I just had to say that because it's kind of important to me. But you're absolutely right that to have a conversation, we have to make some assumptions and go forward. So back to stress, in some ways, if you think about like the most common form of stress that's always talked about, it's work-life balance. And work-life balance problems are a problem of conflicting values. Most of us value doing some kind of worthwhile work or fulfilling work. And we also value, you know, something called life, which is typically family or hobbies or friendships or art or something else. And we just don't have enough time and resources to do both of those things to 100%. And those kinds of conflicts, I think, pretty obviously cause stress. Stress about our to-do lists and how much time we have and how we're managing things.
What is within goal conflict and how can that trip us up?
So within goal conflict is actually about the way that the goal fits you. And so sort of I said that values, they involve kind of all parts of your personality. So the best sorts of values for you are the ones that fit your emotional tendencies and also what you want and also the kinds of judgments you make about what it is for your life to be going well. And some people have conflicts within those different parts of their personalities. So you could imagine somebody who maybe was raised in a very, very conservative kind of community where dancing was not allowed. And you can imagine they leave that community, but then discover dancing at some point and find that it's an absolutely joyful experience. That person might be conflicted they might have a within value conflict in the sense that their emotions are saying, yay, dancing, it's so joyful and awesome. But their judgment is saying, dancing is either bad or trivial or not part of a good life. So those kinds of conflicts they're difficult to deal with because your personality is hard to change, not impossible, but they do create frustration and probably stress.
On the face of it, it seems as if we would all understand our goals even when we're struggling to make them happen. How do hidden goals complicate things for us?
Well, I think there can be times that we want things that we don't admit to ourselves, or we enjoy things, get joy out of things that we don't quite acknowledge that we find them joyful, or there are things that we find boring and tedious where we don't quite admit that to ourselves. And so those are within value conflicts that create problems that are even made more difficult by the fact that the conflict isn't between two things that we, you know, see clearly. You know, if you go back to the dancer that I just mentioned as an example, you could think, well, this might be a person who thinks that they've completely overcome that judging part that says dancing is stupid. You shouldn't love it. Maybe they're in, you know, as we say, they're in denial about that. But that judgment could still be there, kind of hidden and unconscious. And it could mean that for that person, they're never able to fully commit to like taking dance classes or making time for it because they've got this kind of nagging part of their personality that they're not fully aware of that competes with their efforts to do more dancing.
All right, so there are a few different ways we can respond to these conflicts. What does it mean to prioritize and adjust the means we take to an end?
Right, so prioritizing is just which goal are you giving priority to in the moment? And that's something that we're all familiar with from work-life balance conflicts. And, you know, I think most people naturally reprioritize those values of work and family often as things change in their lives. So when you have very young children, you might put more emphasis, give more priority to taking care of your children and being a parent. And as your children get older and need you less, you might shift your priorities so that you put more energy and weight onto your career, maybe, or one of your hobbies. Adjusting means, so that's about prioritizing. Adjusting means to ends is, so when you can identify a kind of general value, like, for instance, health. There are lots of different ways, different means you can take to the end of health, lots of different ways to get there. So if you find that your way of getting health has been maybe observing a kind of special diet that works for you and going to the gym 7 days a week, but then you get a more demanding job or you have children and you think, well, I guess I can't, you know, my health is going to I have to sacrifice my health because I can't, I just can't do this anymore. There might be different means to taking to health. So instead of going to the gym 7 days a week, maybe you can walk to work or bike to work. And that's the means end adjustment, which I think that's the most familiar. Reprioritizing and adjusting the means to ends, those are the most familiar ways that we have of dealing with conflict.
When might it make sense to just let go of a goal that conflicts with our values?
So I think sometimes when you have goals that you are deeply internally conflicted about, so your brain is not all on the same page about this goal, it can make sense to give it up. Sometimes if the conflict with other values that you have, very deeply held values, is just too strong and you can't see any way of resolving it, it can make sense to give up a goal. I do think that it's really hard to give up the sort of basic goals the basic values that we have more or less in virtue of our human nature, like the value of relationships with other people. Those aren't things we can give up, but it might be possible to give up less central kinds of goals that conflict with all the other stuff to such a degree that we just can't fit them all together.
So, for example, you note that if somebody's goal was to become famous, there might actually be like other goals hidden within that that don't present conflicts. So maybe what we really want is to be acknowledged for our work and to be valued.
Great, right. Yeah. So I think, fame and money are two, fame and wealth are two values that are, kind of out there in our culture, lauded even. They're somewhat important to a lot of people. But philosophically, if you look at the history of philosophy and then also the psychological research on happiness and well-being, those aren't goals that tend to fit well with your other goals, and they aren't goals that tend to produce a lot of feelings of happiness. And it's partly because they are relational, so you can't really be famous without other people being not famous, and you can't be famous without other people recognizing who you are. So they're sort of high risk goals, and they're ones that put us on a kind of treadmill because we always want more. You're exactly right. I do think those are goals that we could give up by looking at what's really behind it. So it might be a need to have other people's approval, to think that you're okay. And there are other ways of doing that. You know, one of them is therapy if you're too much like that.
I'll rush to say that you are not a proponent of like embracing false reality, but in what situation might something like delusion actually work to help us drill down to what it is we actually want?
Are you thinking of a particular example?
Well, sort of imagining a perfect world if nothing stood in our way. Is that a useful way to figure out what our goals and values actually are?
Yeah, so I guess because I'm in a field where it hasn't been the most welcoming field for women, and particularly when I was younger, it wasn't. Maybe it's changed a little bit now, but I've thought a lot about the ways in which things have stood in my way, that, I mean, sexism has stood in my way. And there's something about imagining the world without sexism that has been helpful to me, because I could think, well, what is it that I really like about this profession and doing what I do? And what would that look like if the world were fair? And that helps me think about, you know, how could I maybe contribute to making the world a better, more fair place? So I think, you know, it's not just sexism presents that kind of obstacle. Obviously, other forms of prejudice and bias have similar sorts of features, you know, racism, homophobia, all those sorts of things. But even if you have limitations on what you can do that are more personal and don't have to do with social groups, thinking about imagining what things would be like if you didn't confront those obstacles can be a good way of reframing your values, because you might think, well, these obstacles, I would value removing these obstacles, and so I'm going to dedicate some part of my life to trying to remove these obstacles for other people.
Is there a good way to know for sure that our values and goals are truly our own, as opposed to the things that are maybe imposed on us by outside forces and then kind of become internalized?
Right. So there's a certain way in which, you know, you're never going to be like, this is the sense in which I'm not an existentialist, going back to an earlier question that you asked. There's a certain extent to which your choices are not, you're not making choices in a vacuum. At the very least, you've been influenced by your family and your peers about all sorts of choices that you've made that have made you into the person that you are. So I don't really believe that there's a kind of pure self who makes these choices and could even possibly make them without any influence from other people. So that's a sort of false ideal. But you can think about how much you can think about the influence you've had on your values and the goals that you pursue, and ask yourself whether it's working for you or working for somebody else. there's sometimes we do things that that if we are able to kind of step back and get some distance on it, you can see, well, I'm doing that because it serves other people's interests, not mine. So there is, you know, I don't think that's very easy, but we are sometimes capable of getting that kind of distance and asking the question, does this value, this or this goal that I'm pursuing actually fit my personality? Is it making me happy? Or is it really serving the needs of some other person?
Valerie, if we decide we want to just make peace with what we don't have the power to change, maybe let a goal go, what are some ways we can do that?
Yeah, so I think that sometimes we can learn to just laugh at ourselves and to think, well, that's just who I am, and it's okay. So in the book, I talk a little bit about maybe too much about how I'm kind of a pleaser personality. I think it's because I'm Canadian. I don't know, but I don't like to make other people upset. I don't like people to be angry with me. I like to make people happy when I can. And to some degree, that's not a great way to be for an academic professional, especially when I went into administration. It's not a good trait for an administrator because you just can't make everybody happy.
Right.
And I thought, well, what sort of worked for me is to recognize, I mean, I could try to reduce my pleaser tendencies a little bit, but only so much. There's only so far that your personality will move. But I think the key is, if you're going to acknowledge that, you know, that's for various reasons that I maybe, look, I can grasp, that's how I am, that's just what I'm like, you can try to kind of find it cute or funny, like one of your friends might find it cute or funny about you. And importantly, you can emphasize to yourself, and this has been important to me, to emphasize to yourself, that's not my value. That is just a fact about my personality that I have to work around. It is not my goal to make everybody happy. That's not important. It's just my tendency. So does that make sense? So you're kind of reframing it as not a value, but as just, you know, a roadblock or something to get past.
Sure. Are there, you know, of course we get to choose our goals and values to a large extent. Are there good ways to be sure those goals are not causing harm to other people?
Ooh, that's a hard question. I think we have to be, you know, because again, we are social creatures, because other people are so important in our web of values. You know, we value relationships, and many of the things we value, other people are crucial to doing those things. We do need to be, it behooves us to be sensitive to how other people are responding to what we do. So if you value friendship and therefore you want to be a good friend, you don't just want to have friends, you want to actually be a good friend in relationship with other people. Part of that value is acknowledging that it matters how your friends respond to you, whether they think you're doing a good job. So you don't actually succeed at being a good friend if your friends think you're a total jerk, right? Actual strategies for thinking, you know, how do we find out what other people, how other people are responding to us? How do we know if we've hurt other people? You know, I'm not much of an expert about that. But I do think listening to other people with an open mind is pretty key. And one of the things I emphasize in as a kind of trait of good friends is having a certain amount of humility and not thinking that we already know what our friends think, or that our friends are exactly like us, or that all the things they care about are exactly the things we care about. So that's sort of having a bit of humility about what we know about other people can be helpful in trying to figure out how what we're doing is affecting them.
I'm glad you brought up humility, because I think the culture tells us the only way to succeed at something is to never stop believing we can do it. Is it possible that humility might somehow hinder our pursuit of goals?
Yes. So that's a good point. If you have too much humility, if you're so inclined to think that you don't know anything, that you never act on your own beliefs about the world, you'll be in a good bit of trouble. So I think humility, if you think of it as a good trait, it's got to be at a kind of midpoint between, you know, obnoxious arrogance and a kind of like meekness that's debilitating. So absolutely, I think, and in fact, that's there's a very long tradition in philosophy that thinks virtuous traits, the good traits, are always at the midpoint between two extremes. And I think that's definitely true about the kind of humility that's good. It can't go so far as to make you incapable of doing anything.
The midpoint is really interesting here. Utilitarian philosophy says the moral choice is just about always the one that provides maximum benefits for the largest possible number of people. By that way of thinking, it would be more moral to take the money we've saved for like a down payment on our own home and donate it to some organization that provides housing for lots of people. What should we do when we find ourselves wondering whether self-interest and morality might be in conflict?
Wow, that's such a great question. Pretty much, you know, the question moral philosophers have been pondering for thousands of years. So I actually, in the book, and really I would say in my teaching also, I don't really defend any particular moral perspective or moral theory or way of thinking. So what I say about utilitarianism in the book is it could be right. It could be the right way to think about what our moral obligations are. But not that many of us are the kinds of utilitarians who would give our down payment on the house that our dream house to needy people in foreign lands. So my strategy is to say, look, maybe the moral demands on us are very high. Maybe they're too high for most of us to meet. What can we do that's kind of compatible with flourishing as individual, as the individual people that we are? And there I tend to think about the demands to do good for others in terms of trying to do your fair share. So if everyone were to give 5%, maybe 10% of that down payment for the house to some very worthwhile organizations that are trying to solve the world's problems, we'd be a lot better off. And so I tend to think about these moral requirements in terms of what's your fair share of this, of the burden of the world's big problems.
Yeah, that explanation, 5 or 10%, makes really good sense, because it seems to me, Valerie, if we set such high moral standards for ourselves that we inevitably fail to meet them, we're not actually creating the good life for ourselves. We're setting ourselves up for a lifetime of misery.
Right. And if you set the standard so high that you think, well, I'll never meet that, so I might as well not do anything. Mm. That's terrible, right? I mean, it's like if you want to get fit and you say, okay, I'm going to get fit, I'm going to run a marathon in 2 weeks. I think you'd probably pretty quickly think, oh, it's hopeless. I'm not going to bother. So it is important to have goals that are realistic. And I kind of think that's true for morality also. I should be clear that, you know, I'm not saying that that's how morality is. I mean, maybe morality is quite a bit demanding and we are always failing by that standard. But the questions I'm interested in are, you know, as a person, how should you live your own life?
How can other people be a source of support for us as we pursue our values?
So there's probably some obvious ways, like if you want to get fit, I don't know why I'm thinking about marathons right now because I'm never going to run one. But if you wanted to run a marathon, you know, your friends can help you in some sort of pretty obvious ways, like they can go running with you or encourage you to run or help you buy some shoes or send you to websites about how to train for marathons. But one way I think other people can help us that's maybe not so obvious is that I think often instead of giving up our values or changing their priority, what we really need to do is reinterpret them. So if you think that career success means getting promoted to the top management level by the time you're 30 and making $200,000 salary by the time you're 50, those are your standards of success, you might be quite frustrated because the world might not cooperate with you in terms of your very specific ways of understanding your goal. So I think often we have to reinterpret what success in any kind of goal means to us. What does it mean to be a good parent? What does it mean to be a good lawyer or administrator or teacher or nurse? And other people can model different ways of understanding how to live up to those values that we share.
So I personally believe that people can be equally moral whether or not they have a religious tradition. I will say, though, that if you are part of a sort of traditional religious faith, often you're encouraged kind of on a regular basis to examine your own behavior and your own motivation and check in with whether you are meeting the things that you have decided are your values. What's a way that secular folks can sort of regularly check in on their own values? Is there, you know, should once a week we sit down for half an hour and think about these things?
God, that's a great question. I do think that some kind of plan or ritual of self-checking is a good idea. I think I do that in my own life. I think once a week is too often because maybe you were joking. I think once a week, because I think so there's a kind of a balance, because if you're always considering, am I doing the right thing? Am I doing the right thing? You're not in it, you know? Mm. So think about a marriage. Maybe actually that's probably a bad example. Think about a relationship where you have not decided yet to get married or to commit to each other or live together or whatever, and you're wondering what the future is of this relationship. So every Sunday you sit down and you think, is this the right one? Is this worth it? It's not enough time to let the relationship blossom. You have to kind of live it to find out what good it has to offer. If you're always wondering, is this person actually good enough for me? Is this a good fit? You'll undercut the very good things about the relationship. But I think that's true with all of our values, that we have to live them and we have to be fully in and committed and not wondering, is this right? Am I doing this wrong? So I think less frequently, I mean, it's one thing I think's nice about the tradition of setting New Year's resolutions. I'm not a huge fan of resolutions per se, but you can use the beginning of the year or the end of the year as a time to think, well, how did this year go? How did I do at spending my time on the things that matter to me most?
Valerie Tiberius is Paul W. Frenzel Chair in Liberal Arts and Professor of Philosophy at the University of Minnesota. Her book is called What Do You Want Out of Life? A Philosophical Guide to Figuring Out What Matters. Valerie, so nice speaking with you. Thanks for making time.
Thanks so much for inviting me. It was delightful to talk to you.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram. You can subscribe to our podcast just by searching for KERA Think. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.